Today we begin what will be a sort of periodic series. We spent a great deal of time rediscovering America's first libertarian movement, vulgarly called Locofocoism. And now, as we follow the lives of the last Locofocos through to the end, we should pause from time to time to take stock and find meaning in what they did. Therefore, we're going to start an investigation of a wide array of profiles in locodom. We will choose several individuals from the movement whose biographies represent the many different types and styles of Locofoco. And first up, we have Fernando Wood, New York City's wartime mayor, a Locofoco going back to the mid-1830s, and the consummate political double dealer. To see what we can make of Wood and his influence on the Locofoco movement, I've invited PhD candidate Nicholas Mosvik on the show. Mosvik is writing a dissertation on civil liberties during the Civil War at the University of Mississippi, and he is one of the very few experts on Fernando Wood. Welcome to Liberty Chronicles, a project of libertarianism.org. I'm Anthony Comegna. Okay, so Nicholas, let's start off talking about Fernando Wood's very, very early life. Is there anything relevant from his upbringing, his childhood, his days as a young man that went into informing his very long and influential political career?
Yes, well, there's probably two things that stand out. And one is that his family background was that of Quakers. So his first family members to come over to the United States came over in 1650 from Wales. And his father, in fact, was kicked out of the Quakers for being too militant. He also had a grandfather who had his own disputes with the Quakers during the Revolutionary War. So Wood has background as a Quaker, and it's believed that makes him somewhat peaceful and calm as a politician. The other important thing is that very early on, around 20 years old, he's already an entrepreneur, is a cigar maker running a factory in Richmond. So he has this background as an entrepreneur that's going to be very important because Wood will be a rising political figure as a very young man who has not forgotten his background as an entrepreneur.
How did he end up as a cigar manufacturer in Richmond? How did he manage to become a young entrepreneur like that without a start from his family?
It's unclear to me. The background is running a factory in Richmond at 20 comes from a biography that was made of Fernando Wood while he was actually mayor. That official biography does not actually specify. So in some ways, I think his rise as an entrepreneur is sort of part of his political myth that sells him as a working class politician, right? So this, as we'll talk about, Wood is really an important part of the early Tammany Hall politics. So his ability, as we'll talk about later, early in his political career to connect to working New Yorkers is an important part of his political appeal. But I'm not sure how it is he ends up in Richmond, because very soon after that, he's back in New York City as a cigar maker.
Now, see, that's very interesting to me. I mean, like so many of these other figures, a lot of the details of his life, especially early on, are very spotty. And it's hard to get a firm grasp on what, you know, a young man on the make and on the move is dealing with day to day, or exactly what his motivations might be, too. But, you know, he does end up getting caught up in the swirls of Locofocoism in the mid-1830s. And I wondered if you could give us an idea of what is his philosophy as he first starts to get involved in politics? And, you know, what are the issues that are really concerning to him?
Well, I think it's the issues that stand out, right? The 1830s are a time of a lot of economic, not just panic, right, but some very important economic events, right? So we have the Panic of 1837, which is a really a seminal event in the 19th century. This comes on the tail of Andrew Jackson's time as president and his famous specie circular, right? So his push for hard money, right? And so there's a reaction to this panic that for Wood and other Democrats who are with Tammany Hall to shift them to more conservative views, right? And that has to do with who they necessarily blame for these economic events, right? And really going back to the Panic of 1819, the conservative reaction is to blame the larger financial order for these economic panics.
Now, as you said, he's sort of shifted his views during the Panic of 1837, as did a lot of other Democrats. Now, I feel, just permit me a sort of diatribe here about the ins and outs of early Locofoco politics. Wood was somebody who was, in my research at least, he first shows up on Tammany Hall's Young Men's General Committee, which is one of the steering committees to nominate candidates and to drive Tammany Hall policy. But it's reserved for young activists, young Democrats. And then there's the Old Men's Committee, which is sort of supposed to be your seasoned citizens who are well-versed in how Tammany works. And Wood gets recruited to the Young Men's Committee because he has been reading William Leggett, and he's been involving himself somewhat in the radical Locofoco politics of the day. But he's still seen by Tammany Hall as a conservative, and they think they can get him on the committee as a conservative force within the young men's orbit. And everybody knew that it was the young men who were represented by Locofocoism, right? So you get the right young men on the young men's committee, and the conservatives can still take the wind out of Locofoco sails. But then the Flower Riot changes things. How would you say Wood is a radical?
Well, my knowledge of Wood tends to be a little later in his career. But what I would say his overall career suggests is that his consistent radicalism has to do with sort of, as you suggested in some ways, bridging this gap between this Locofoco tendency towards what we would now call libertarianism and these older conservative values. And that really goes back to his perspective as a young man and entrepreneur, right? His ability to connect with working people and again, to really bridge this divide, right? In some ways, what makes Wood radical is his ability to kind of, jump ship politically at times, right? To take these views that are somewhat surprising. So as we'll talk about during the Civil War, that's how Wood really shifts from someone known as more conservative to someone known as a peace Democrat.
Just I suppose just to finish up the brief story of his early politics in New York City, he was that peace Democrat. His position on the Young Men's Committee was, let's make peace between the Democratic Party of Van Buren and this new thing, the Equal Rights Party, the sort of protest party among the Locofocos, right? So, like, especially for me, there's Fernando Wood on the Young Men's Committee, and then there's someone like Levi Slam, who has been a character recurring on the show. Levi Slam is the Equal Rights Party official responsible for calling meetings. And he refuses to call meetings because he wants Locofocos to make joint nominations with Tammany, meaning he wants them to work with people like Wood and make peace with the Democratic Party. So he refuses to call meetings, and the Equal Rights Party dies. and they do merge back with Tammany Hall, thanks in part to people like Wood playing that role of peace Democrat. And, you know, his biographer, Jerome Muscat, says that Locofocoism was both an ideological imperative and a useful political expedient to him.
I think that's a good way to describe his career, because that is going to make sense of how Wood acts both as mayor and then later is a peace Democrat during the Civil War who will find himself elected to Congress in 1863. Really, that driving dynamic of pushing both for peace, maintaining ideological commitments, especially to strict constructionism and limited constitutional powers for the federal government, but also this ability to simultaneously maintain his political edge, or his really ability to keep his own political dynamic together. That will very much remain true during the Civil War, where so-called Mozart Hall Democrats will maintain power at least in the middle of the Civil War.
Now, what can you tell us that's especially important about his career in between these early days of Locofocoism and the Civil War? Because I think most people who ever have heard of him probably heard about him as the mayor of New York City who wanted the city to secede from the Union during the war. But there's surely a lot to fill in between there. So what about his time? I mean, he had a brief stint in Congress in the early 1840s. As I understand it, it's at least a little bit unclear whether he should be classified as a Van Buren man or a Calhoun man. What's your point of view?
I think my reaction to that is the reason is it kind of goes back to what we were just talking about, right? This dynamic that Muscat talks about, this kind of ability to step between ideological commitments and political commitments. And he's only in Congress for one term. And you do see him take some of these more unique and radical positions, right? So for instance, he gives a lengthy speech in 1841, known as the Fiscal Speech, advocating against the bank, right? And so being against the bank nominally makes him a Van Buren man, right? But he also adds, you know, that he believes in the falsity of the, he believes that the Whig prophets, the false Whig prophets are pushing their ability to support this independent treasury through what he calls magic, right? So his attack on sort of the business class and the mercantile class of New York, once again, this really goes back to his early days, but in some ways that can show him is a Van Buren man, right? And he's also makes a famous speech in 1843 against the tariff. So once again, you know, in some ways, I think this can kind of show him to be Van Buren man, where he talks about the need to avoid any protectionism and to keep only the reward of honest industry, and that he was in favor of non-interference, right? So again, tariffs and the banks are both examples of the sort of corruption that would have been reflective of the Van Buren and then the Jacksonian perspective, right? Sort of the spirit of the age, right? But he also talks in that speech about Europe in this kind of global spirit of the age pushing towards free trade. And I don't know if that makes him stand out in some ways against the Van Burenites, but he kind of is taking this to the next step, right? So it's not just that tariffs are corrupt and protectionism, right? But they also go against this spirit of the age in towards free trade, right?
Yeah, he does sort of, you know, I'm glad you brought up that phrase, this sort of spirit of the age, because he does kind of strike me also as a young American. I don't know that I've. I mean, he's too much of a politician for many historians to classify him with a literary movement. But he does seem to be very touched by that idea of manifest destiny and some sort of glorious future that Americans are fulfilling based on loco foco abstract principles. But yet he's somebody with his nose to the ground in politics, and he's able to flit between camps and pursue that vision in sort of a practical way that oftentimes the more agitating loco focos didn't really have patience for. And I find it interesting that even the big politicians like Van Buren or Calhoun didn't have patience for that. And I think they didn't have patience for his position as an ideologue, you know, his sort of romanticism about the American future. They were too pragmatic and politically minded. But Wood, you know, he...
Then that's some ways...
Go ahead.
Then some ways that reflects on his age, right? I mean, this really connects to your description of him as a young man. And in the 1840s, that's very true, right? We're talking about Wood in his early 30s, maybe, right? And those he's dealing with, the Van Buren brothers and Calhoun, are much older, right? Calhoun will die in 1850. Van Buren, by this point, is in his 60s, right? So we're talking about a generational divide as well, right?
Yeah, and he like I said, he tries to again play sort of a peace democrat, and he poses to the Calhoun people as their ally, and he goes to secret strategy sessions of the Calhounites in the throughout the 1840s, especially leading up to I think the 1844 nomination, and he gives the Calhoun people advice about wrangling delegates. And meanwhile, he's reporting to Van Buren everything about the Calhoun people's movements, you know? And the Van Buren people see this as the worst kind of double dealing, which they do themselves all the time, but they don't like it when you know, they can't trust somebody. So they have no respect for Wood. They don't like him. And then Calhoun gets him a patronage job, and Wood stays neutral in the Free Soil election of 1848, right? So again, he's not an agitator. He might be an ideologue, but he's not an agitator.
Yeah. And that's an important distinction, right? Because again, that's the kind of thing that is shot through his political career, is that he has these obvious ideological commitments, but he's really able to keep this delicate political balance that in some ways is really impressive, right?
So take us through his time as mayor and leading into the Civil War. What's important to note about him, and how does he ultimately end up the mayor who wants New York to secede?
Well, I think one thing that stands out that gives us a little bit of insight into Wood as mayor, for one, is that Wood runs for mayor in sort of a fascinating time in American politics, right? So he runs against a know-nothing candidate and a reform candidate, right? So the Whig candidate actually barely gets any votes in this election, right? But it's a four-way election, really. In some ways, Americans might think of not only the 1856 election, but of course the 1860 election as being one of these heavily contested elections because no one got a clear majority, right? So Wood actually wins the mayorship with only around a third of the vote, right? So he gets in, and in his inaugural address in 1855, I think this stands out to me. He talks about his faithful adherence to the framers of the Constitution and the principle of republicanism, that no power should be delegated which can be exercised by the people themselves. So he has this really important commitment to popular sovereignty. And then he immediately puts himself into a political battle. Wood believes that as mayor, he should be head of the police department, right? He complains that the chief of police is made too independent. And he also complains that the New York City Council has too much control over his decision-making power, right? He believes that the mayor should basically be like a president, right? He should have removal power of any officers underneath him, and that basically the police should be like his army, right? They should be his army force, right? So he's making sort of this play for power, and at the same time, the same inaugural address, he's also pushing for things like reducing large expenditures for public schools, right? So again, he shows his character as a conservative, but he's also pushing for more power. And he's also talking at length about corruption, right? One more example we might talk about during his time as mayor is both that he, while he runs against a know-nothing candidate, he still shows himself to be critical of immigrants. He says, quote, immigration is not detrimental as a whole. Among them are honest, industrious, and thrifty people whose presence here may be called a blessing to this country, but it is to that proportion to which I allude, like the Belgians, have been sent out of their country as either paupers or criminals, right? So he's just suspicious of, in particular, Belgians who might come into the city, right? So he really comes in and he has this concern that's rather consistent as a mayor with crime, right? One of his real major goals is trying to empower himself as mayor to get rid of crime in New York City.
Now, that quote is particularly interesting to me, not just because it sounds plucked out of our own day, although I hardly think Belgium would be on the receiving end of criticism today. I've spent time around Belgians, correct. And they're fine people. At least they are now. But you know, it leaps out to me because he very much is a racist. He is a northern racist who has lots of awful things to say about African Americans, free and enslaved. He's very callous toward their interests, and he definitely is a member, at least as far as I can tell, of the sort of doughface wing of the Democratic Party as it relates to slavery and race relations. But it is obviously interesting to see him criticizing white immigration, too. What do we make of that?
Yeah, I think what we make of that is that part of what informs his view as a politician is simply his suspicion of outsiders. That in the 19th century, what is amongst those conservatives who are looking for sort of a pure form of American republicanism and a more American moral character. If we go back to his time as a young man, not only do we think about him as an entrepreneur, we're talking about sort of his commitment to a form of manifest destiny, right? But the question for that, when we think of manifest destiny as historians, is of course for who, right? And Wood has to answer that question, and he gives, I think, a recognizable 19th century conservative answer to that question, which is good Republican citizens who are likely white Protestants, right? So he's not a know-nothing, right? But he still probably shares some of that suspicion with outsiders, right? Those who can be trusted to be committed to both this political project, but also this moral project, right?
Now, he's the firmest of Democrats all the way through the Civil War and Reconstruction period. So what exactly is tell us just about the clash between him and the Lincoln administration while he is mayor of New York City during the war?
Well, so Fernando Wood, he not only clashes with the Lincoln administration as mayor, but even once he's out and he'll be running for Congress really shot throughout the war, he's clashing with Lincoln. And really in that, in some sense, Wood makes himself a leader of these New York politicians, these Democrats who are opposing Lincoln. And it really starts in the first year of the war, right? For instance, as you suggested, Wood is sympathetic to the South. He's sympathetic to secession, right? And that's in some ways a first no-no. It's a first schism, right? Because there will be these Democrats who will become referred to as war Democrats, right? Something that Fernando Wood would have sneered at, right? But the idea being that they're very much committed to fighting the Confederacy and winning this war, right? They have no qualms about secession. They believe what's happened is wrong, right? So from the get-go, Wood is placing himself in opposition. And then shortly after the war starts, Lincoln and the Republicans start wartime policies that Wood and his brethren believe are unconstitutional and wrong, right? Including the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus, and of course, the arrests of some Democrats, and in particular, Democratic newspaper editors, right? So they basically believe that Lincoln and the Republicans are using the war and their increased powers to go after their political opponents. And in some ways, we can see that this pushes Wood over time towards becoming more radical, right? He doesn't start the war as a peace Democrat, but somehow by 1863, he's really talking about pushing for peace with the Confederacy.
Now, so then how does that lead us to New York City should be a free trade, free state? That's a leap that it seems like, you know, the vast majority of Americans would not have been making. So what is it about, you know, his thinking that says this is the way to go?
I think, I believe that it's really a combination, right? For one, I think Wood very much sees himself as a powerful figure, and he's not incorrect in that, right? He has significant backing. But he also, I think, understands that even if there is sort of this war going on between Mozart Hall, his supporters, and Tammany Hall, that New York Democrats broadly don't support the Lincoln administration, right? There's this sort of the sense that, well, of course we could do this because here in New York, not only are there draft riots, but really throughout the war in 1863 in particular, there's really a lot of opposition to the Lincoln war policies amongst New Yorkers and especially New York Democrats. So there's this sense that it's at least possible. And of course, Wood already ideologically believes that secession isn't wrong. And I think lastly, there's this sense, especially by 1863, that there are enough Democrats who are pushing for peace elsewhere in the North that if New York City leaves, other cities might go too, right? Or at least other areas of the North, right? You know, we might recall that this is around the time that Clement Vallandigham, the representative from Ohio, has been arrested by the Lincoln administration for speaking out against their war policies, and he'll be shortly after sent to the South, right? And Vallandigham is another major peace Democrat, right? So there's this sort of linking of arms, right? Kind of the sense that they have as much clout as they're going to have at that time to be able to push for their policies.
It will be quite some time before we catch up to Reconstruction on the show, but we will get there. Needless to say, New York City never successfully secedes. Boy, it would have been nice. But nonetheless, Wood is an important figure moving forward in the Democratic Party. bringing again these old factions back together after the war and trying to reunite what used to be this old big Locofoco coalition. So, you know, I sort of see people like Wood as the free trade Democrats who would, you know, ignore or give up any kind of racial equality issues. They don't care about that. They care mostly about free trade, limited government. And then there's the other Locofocos, people like William Cullen Bryant or John Bigelow, who took over for William Leggett at the Evening Post. They went with the Republican Party because, you know, the inequalities related to race and slavery were so much more important to them, at least momentarily, than free trade. But after the war and after abolition, somebody like Wood, still being around in the Democratic Party, serves again as a vehicle to bring these factions back together and to heal the wounds opened by the slavery politics, to, you know, the more radical egalitarian Locofocos. They can say, oh, well, we accomplished abolition. We got our main goals and we smashed the slaveholders' monopoly. So now we can come back to the Democratic Party and fight against the money power, the banks, and all that stuff again. And Wood is again this conduit back to some sort of democratic consensus. What do we make of this person in the end? What impact did he have on the libertarian movement of his day?
I think what we make of him is part of it is what you just alluded to, right? Is that after the war, it says a lot about the politics of the day, that there's also this sort of this desire to go back to the way things were, right? So he starts off as a young man. We talk about him kind of representing some of these new ideals in the 1840s, kind of pushing for free trade globally and these more libertarian Locofoco positions. And by the late 1860s, that's sort of wanting to return to a world that doesn't really quite exist anymore, right? But because Fernando Wood also was a racist who supported slavery, it was far easier to really attach himself back to some of those free trade positions. So I think what this tells us is the degree to which 19th century political history and the Locofoco and early libertarian movements are complicated narrative, right? So at once, they inform us about these radical movements that may have pushed Americans to support positions that ultimately would be for the better, support of free trade for one. But these were also personally people who weren't necessarily attached to the same moral commitments we have now, right? They're not only racist, right, but suspicious of outsiders, right? Their idea of community, their idea of who really is involved both in this democratic project and this free trade project is also inherently limited. And the Civil War in some ways doesn't change that for somebody like Fernando Wood, right? But he maintains power after the war precisely because for a lot of Americans, once the war is over, they are hoping to heal the wounds and sort of return to the world that they knew, right? And once again, I think part of that story is to know that once we get to Reconstruction, we talk about Reconstruction, that really isn't something that could happen, right? It's a forlorn hope.
Yeah. And just like eventually as people like Wood die, really the whole concept of Locofocoism dies with them. And as I've alluded to a little bit before, people like Benjamin Tucker are left behind to sort of gather the pieces back together. And they have to adopt this new word, this strange European import, libertarian.
I think the last thing I would add, because I didn't really talk enough about it during the Civil War, which is that this sort of complicated narrative, this complicated person that Wood is, is a peace Democrat who is sympathetic to the South, But we can also understand him, as you've mentioned, as someone really being committed to peace throughout, right? In the sense that someone would want to avoid the increasing and awful violence of the Civil War is something we should try our best to understand, right? Not because we're looking to question the war or its outcome itself, but trying to understand why a position like that would be rational in 1863, when the war was really starting to reach the heights of its bloodshed, right? And I think that's important, right, to understand that there's a moment in which a movement for peace has some really legitimate prospects because the war has become such a bloody, awful mess.
Nicholas Mosvik is a PhD candidate in American history at the University of Mississippi, where his research focuses on the constitutional arguments over conscription during the Civil War. He has a JD MA from the University of Virginia School of Law's Legal History Program, and he has worked for the Cato Institute as a legal associate in the Center for Constitutional Studies. Liberty Chronicles is a project of libertarianism.org. It is produced by Tess Terrible. If you've enjoyed this episode of Liberty Chronicles, please rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. For more information on Liberty Chronicles, visit libertarianism.org.